In honoring the memory of Wilson Schmidt, two factors, one personal and the other professional, have influenced me to write on the theme, or to talk this afternoon on the theme, of the need to reform the World Bank. The professional factor is that Wilson Schmidt's own interests were very much focused on this subject, and were it not for his untimely death, he undoubtedly would have made great inroads in reforming the World Bank as its executive director from the United States. The personal reason was that I was a candidate to replace Wilson Schmidt in that job, though fate and the Reagan administration obviously had other things for me in mind. The first 2 years of the Reagan administration indicate that indeed Wilson Schmidt may very well have made a difference in controlling the international economic institutions that presently threaten the prosperity of the global economy. The reform that the Reagan administration had promised upon taking power quite simply has not materialized. Rather than tame the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund as advertised at the beginning of his administration, the Reagan administration has been tamed by them, as was all too obvious this afternoon. The wrong people obviously have gotten to Treasury Secretary Donald Regan, who now champions the idea of a bailout of the debt-ridden third world countries through the IMF to promote a global stability that will continue to elude us so long as such bailouts are practiced, particularly by those who have been chosen for their office precisely for the purpose of discontinuing them. If Wilson had lived, maybe he would have been able to talk some sense to his boss. Maybe he could have explained that the international capital markets, not the international bureaucrats, are uniquely qualified to solve the problems that the banks and the LDCs have gotten themselves into. After all, that's what Reaganomics was supposed to be about. In fact, I think what we've seen is a sad deterioration of Reaganomics from a meaningful system, a free market approach to economic behavior, to virtually a tautology. Because today, Reaganomics is little more than the policies that President Reagan follows. It has nothing to do with the free market approach, or little to do with the free market approach to economic phenomena. The task facing the Western economies after World War II were truly enormous. The war had ravaged the European economies, and their reconstruction became an objective of the highest priority, both to the United States and to the European countries themselves. Moreover, there was a growing realization that a prosperous and stable world order could not proceed without full participation of the poorer or lesser developed countries of the world. To many, the supply of private savings and capital appeared inadequate to accomplish the twin task of reconstruction and development. The International Bank of Reconstruction and Development, the World Bank, was created after the war to supplement the supply of private capital with public capital. The original and fundamental purpose of the World Bank was to create wealth, not to transfer it. It was to achieve this noble purpose by assisting the private sector. The faith placed in the private sector by the international community in those early post-war years proved not to have been misplaced. Western Europe is not only back on its feet, but a major economic force again, threatened only, I might add, by its own welfare state, while the poorer nations of the world have made remarkable economic progress. The World Bank, however, captured by people who have little understanding of and faith in the private sector, has dramatically veered from its original purpose. Instead of creating wealth, the World Bank today is more interested in transferring wealth. Instead of promoting third world development by supplementing private capital, the World Bank today frustrates development by crowding out private capital. Under Robert McNamara's leadership, the World Bank has become increasingly involved in income and wealth distribution to help the poor in the third world. Here are a few examples of specific World Bank loans for this purpose during recent years, and I'll just read one or two. a $32 million loan to the Philippines, quoted in the World Bank report about, this is a quote from the World Bank report as to the purpose of that loan, about 180,000 residents of Tondo, one of Manila's worst slums, will benefit from an urban development project in which health, nutrition, and other social service improvements will be integrated with improvements in water supply, sewerage, and drainage projects. At $87 million loan to India, quote, capabilities of the administrative authorities in the Calcutta Metropolitan District will be expanded and upgraded. About 1.8 million poor residents will benefit from fringe development and slum improvement schemes, and some 45,000 people will have improved housing. A $93 million loan to Brazil. More than 80,000 low-income families will benefit from improved housing and better health and education. Health and education facilities through sites and services and a low-cost housing project in two northeastern states in Greater São Paulo. Now I say what the third world poor need more than anything else is relief from domestic government policies that impoverish their economies, not income transfer from the industrialized countries. By trying to help the poor directly rather than through promoting economic growth, the World Bank bails out offending governments by negating the costs of their ill-conceived policies. In so doing, it encourages the continuation of such policies and thus the continuation of the poverty of those it pretends to assist. If the World Bank were to discontinue its poverty program from afar, the main beneficiaries would be the third world poor themselves. Occasionally, the World Bank's wrong-headed approach to helping the poor has involved it in projects that seriously jeopardize the human rights of the poor people concerned. Peter Bauer mentioned the Tanzanian catastrophe this morning. The example that I would like to refer to is the Indonesian Transmigration Project. Despite the fact that McNamara was strongly criticized for his support, the World Bank has persisted in aiding the Indonesian government in forcibly uprooting 500,000 families from Java for shipment to several small barren islands off the coast of Indonesia. In its annual reports, the World Bank justifies this Hitler-esque deportation of poor peoples on the grounds of, in quotes, upgrading crop production, generating employment opportunities, improving livelihoods. So far, taxpayers throughout the industrialized world, through the World Bank, have subsidized the Indonesian government in this attack on the human rights of its own citizens to the tune of $785 million. This is precisely the type of thing that has occurred as the World Bank has moved into the poverty area, and it is not an isolated incident. When the World Bank moved away from its original wealth-creating purpose to pursue social objectives, a Pandora's box of dubious projects opened up. Diversifying industry away from congested areas does not appear to be a policy geared to increasing economic growth. Yet, the World Bank has made at least two loans for this purpose, one in Brazil, the other in Thailand. The justification of a recent loan to Brazil was that industries will be diversified away from São Paulo and the Rio de Janeiro areas. Perhaps the most serious charge against the World Bank is that it is financing socialism in less developed countries by crowding out private capital in areas in which private capital has a comparative advantage. Consider the following loans that enable third world governments to capture industries that properly belong within the sphere of the private sector. Algeria. A $46 million loan. This loan to a state-owned construction materials enterprise will assist in financing the construction of a cement plant capable of producing 500,000 tons a year. Kenya, a $40 million loan. The project will help meet the country's expected growth and power demand from 1981 to 1985 and will assist in reducing dependence on imported fuel through the drilling of geothermal steam wells, construction of a generating station comprising two 15-milliwatt units, and so on. What is the government of Kenya, in other words, doing in the geothermal energy business? India. $105 million loan. The project will help increase fertilizer production in this country's existing plants from about 60% to capacity and so on and so forth. What right does the Indian government have to be in the fertilizer business? Although this one may speak for itself. The following two loans are particularly important since they exemplify recent World Bank activity in the energy area. And I'm referring to a $400 million loan that the World Bank made, and then another $150 million loan that they made in the Bombay High project. The World Bank loan to the Bombay High project has had at least two deleterious consequences. First, it has imposed an unnecessary cost on taxpayers in the industrialized world by offering a subsidy that was not needed to initiate the project. Second, it has enabled the public sector to crowd out the private sector from jobs that the private sector can do more efficiently. Beryl W. Sprinkle, Undersecretary of the U.S. Treasury, argued that it is folly for the World Bank to throw massive amounts of money into those kinds of projects when there is an industry that is the most highly financed of all, that is very competitive, and that can do a marvelous job of bottom line explorations. That, I should say, is what I call Beryl Sprinkle 1. Today we heard Beryl Sprinkle 2, just like we have M1 and M2. The only thing is that M1 and M2 are not contradictory, while Sprinkle 1 and Sprinkle 2 may be. According to a published interview, Undersecretary Sprinkle's chief objection to the Bombay High project lies in the fact that with the World Bank's critical help, India has taken the most promising lands for the government to develop. The result has been that the major private oil companies are not interested in exploring what's left. Unfortunately, the Bombay High project is typical of World Bank involvement in the energy field. Although the World Bank is supposed to be a catalyst in attracting private capital, an examination of the 27 loans totaling $1.2 billion for oil and gas shows little evidence of this. In fact, none of the 27 loans made by the bank involve private oil company financial participation, either equity or debt. The inescapable conclusion is that World Bank loans to national oil companies for exploration and development have displaced private capital. Other World Bank types of World Bank loans is not only the type that crowd out private capital, but loans that are given for infrastructure purposes. And the infrastructure argument is an argument that has suckered in, I must say, many economists during the last several decades. That somehow, you know, government has a comparative advantage in infrastructure, the building of roads, telephone lines, port facilities. And you have this theory that was perpetrated on us by development experts that somehow the infrastructure leads economic growth, and therefore government leads the growth process. I call that type of economics cart before the horse economics, because what has been shown clearly in the third world country is that it is not government that leads economic growth. It's the private sector that leads economic growth, or that sparks economic growth. And government comes in somewhere along the line. Government comes in as an absorber, a user of wealth, but a beneficiary of the growth itself. And after you have a private economic boom, there's needs for roads, then the government can come in and build some roads, and we know that the rate of return on those projects are going to be high. When the roads are built before the demand is there, you have the case of roads where there are no cars to drive on them. Telephone wires when there's no business to transact over the telephone. And ports with no boats coming in and out. That has been the case in all too many LDCs. So we don't want to be the victim of cart before the horse economics, and I'm afraid that the World Bank has been. Crowding out of private capital, wasting scarce resources on infrastructure projects, and the assumption of an income and wealth transfer function in the world economy are three deviations of the World Bank from its original purpose. The fourth is encroachment by the World Bank into the territory of the International Monetary Fund. The International Monetary Fund was established at the close of World War II along with the World Bank, though for a different purpose. Rather than finance specific development projects and reconstruction, the purpose of the IMF was to assist member countries, developed and less developed, to finance temporary imbalances in their international balance of payments and foreign exchange shortages. The IMF was part of the Bretton Woods International Monetary System, which called for fixed exchange rates. With the adoption of floating exchange rates, there is a real question today whether or not the IMF has a legitimate positive role to play in the world economy any longer. Ironically, just as real doubts have been raised as to the continued existence of the IMF, the World Bank also has moved in the direction of helping countries with balance of payments problems. That is, the World Bank has moved into the area of general economic support rather than solely project-related assistance. Moreover, in rendering general economic assistance, the World Bank has not made conditionality a requirement. This is unlike the IMF practice, where the loan is made on condition that the borrowing country take corrective action to put its balance of payments and foreign exchange position in order. The implicit assumption behind the traditional IMF practice of conditionality is that the domestic policies of the borrowing country are at fault for its international economic problems and that the IMF loan is not a blank check. Support is contingent upon taking steps to correct the problem. The World Bank, however, has taken another view that external circumstances, specifically OPEC and the so-called oil crisis, that's the positive oil price, the oil crisis with rising prices, now we have the oil crisis with falling prices, are responsible for the balance of payments difficulties of third world countries. Accordingly, conditionality has not been made a part of non-project World Bank loans. At a minimum, conditionality must be made a part of both World Bank and IMF assistance to borrowers if the loans themselves are not to become a cause of continued economic difficulties. The prospect of these being a blank check, however, is more likely if the international bureaucrats get their way. But conditionality is not enough. Conditionality assumes that the international bureaucrats who impose the conditions know what's ailing the economy. This is what was so wrong with Beryl Sprinkle's talk this afternoon, is that he assumes that everything is all right as long as you have conditionality. But do we have confidence that the people at the World Bank know what's ailing the third world countries? They certainly haven't demonstrated it in the past. They've made many, many loans, and we still have a lot of poverty out there. The fact of the matter is that the IMF economists have shown themselves to be suspect in this regard. And let me take the case of Mexico as an example. Mexico is a case that's given where, well, the loans are made, but we're getting the Mexican government to impose certain conditions which are going to lead to an adjustment. Effective adjustment is the key word. But what's wrong with the Mexican economy? Is what's wrong with the Mexican economy that their taxes are too low? Is that the problem? That taxes are too low in Mexico? Yet, what the World Bank wanted to do, what the IMF wanted to do in Mexico, is that raise taxes and cut government spending as a condition for the loans. The problem, in other words, with two big deficits on the part of the government, and if the deficits could be reduced, that would be the conditions. But deficits can be reduced in two ways, raising taxes or lowering expenditures. So that Mexico would theoretically fulfill its commitment by raising taxes. Now, my analysis of what's wrong with Mexico has nothing to do, or only minor part, is this idea of budget deficit. Budget deficit's a problem. I'm not in favor of budget deficits. But the fact of the matter is Mexico has more serious problems. As I pointed out in my book, Development Without Aid, and as I pointed out in a Wall Street Journal article about 2 years ago, Will Mexico Make Iran's Mistakes, was the title of the piece. Mexico's problem is that they have wasted the oil money. And they've wasted the oil money because the government has been running the oil sector and took the profits and put them in the wrong type of investments. Mexico is building steel plants and petrochemical plants when it is in fact a labor-abundant economy. We know from introductory economics that labor-abundant economies specialize in capital-intensive industries only at their own peril. The fact of the matter is that if that money was invested in labor-intensive industries, then the situation in Mexico, I am sure, would be not nearly as desperate as it is today. And certainly, it would give employment to Mexican workers so we wouldn't have this artificially induced inflow of workers across the border or across the Rio Grande. Now, we can't expect governments to invest their resources in unsexy, unprestige, labor-intensive industries like plastics, like clothing, like toys. Remember how Hong Kong, how Singapore, how Japan got their starts. They didn't get their starts by specializing in steel and financial services, sophisticated financial services, as was being done in Hong Kong today. They started small. They made profits. They were labor-abundant economies. They followed, in other words, the law of comparative advantage, and they prospered. And the best guarantee that the law of comparative advantage will be followed is free markets. Because businessmen, when they go into an economy, they say, is labor cheap? If labor is cheap, they'll go in and build what? Capital-intensive investments or labor-intensive investments? Obviously, labor-intensive investments if labor is cheap. So if the free market is left to itself, you will find the international marketplace having the result that labor-abundant economies like Mexico, like Iran was, but they're special labor-abundant economies. They're labor-abundant economies with oil. And the exact same thing happened to the Shah. In fact, I was injudicious enough to argue that one of the reasons that the Shah did not die in peace on the Peacock Throne was that he never took a lesson in economics from Milton Friedman. Because Milton would have taught him the law of comparative advantage. He would have taught them that it doesn't pay for a midget to go into professional basketball, or for Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain to pursue a career as a jockey. And if the Shah was bright enough to learn that one lesson, there is a good chance that he would not have been as foolish enough to throw away the oil money in white elephant industries, the same thing that Mexico did. And perhaps the economy would have been more buoyant, and perhaps the mullahs would not have received as much broad-based support as they did when they launched their revolution. So to sum up, my feelings are this. We should not place our faith in international bureaucrats on conditionality. We have an international capital market. The international capital market can do its job as far as the present crisis of loans to third world countries is concerned. Let the third world countries and the banks work it out themselves. If there's any role for government, perhaps it is to increase the insurance of depositors at major banks so that if one or two or three banks sustain substantial losses, that there wouldn't be a run on those banks, which it seems to be a great fear. Other than that, I have my faith. Beryl Sprinkle today said he couldn't see any other approach but the IMF. What other approach is there? And I say the other approach is the international free capital market. Thank you very much. Well, the way to give gifts is take a trip to some poor country and single out some person you take a shine to and give him or her a gift, or give him and her an organization a gift privately. The problem is, of course, that the aid, as is well known, I don't want to repeat what Peter Bauer has said, but aid that's given government to government, humanitarian aid, never gets to the people it's supposed to supposed to help. Well, very seldom. All right, I'll say very seldom. If you've got an example of where it did, I'd be glad to hear it. I don't know of any case myself. In any event, I would say a little private initiative in gift giving would be welcome.
I think if you don't accept Milton Friedman's argument, the government is more efficient.
In what?
Capitalism in gift giving. Capitalism and freedom.
Well, I don't accept it, but I am sure that if Milton was here, he probably convinced me I was wrong. But
thought occurs to me, you use Mexico and Iran as two prime examples. They both shared two characteristics. One was all pervasive corruption and the effectiveness of the corruption arose because every type of economic activity, whether it was imports or exports, building a building, whatever it might be, required the approval of a government bureaucracy and created, therefore, an opportunity for the bureaucrats or the courtiers, whatever you want to call them, in Mexico, it's the thugs at the border, to extract something under the table, and in some cases, something very large. Would it be at all reasonable to suggest that one essential precondition of international bank, IMF, government to government, or any other type of lending, simply be that the country who is the recipient must, before a dollar is dispensed, abolish the regulations that make the all-pervasive corruption possible? That tends to be self-enforcing, because if you eliminate those regulations, you get a whole bunch of things out of the way of the private sector, and it will always spring up.
Well, if you eliminate the regulations, if you eliminate big government, if you eliminate the interference in the marketplace, you will eliminate corruption. You will also eliminate the need for foreign aid. The country will have a private market, it will grow, poor people will be helped through economic growth, and the problem will disappear.
You used the example of, in your article in the Manhattan Report and others, about the labor-intensive countries, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, etc. I think we also have an example here in the United States of the same type of model, and that's been in the South, where you've had labor-intensive industries where labor is cheaper, and capital has flowed to southern states, and we find that in some Sun Belt today, these are now involved in computers, in microchip technology, and financial services. My home state of Texas is an example. Would you amplify that?
Well, I think that, of course, it's proof of my thesis. I developed a concept in my book, which I call the transfer of prosperity, the international transfer of prosperity, which I'm in favor of, as opposed to the international transfer of income, which I'm against. The international transfer of prosperity involves the use of, another way of saying it, is the free market approach to economic development. Through international trade, through free capital movements, and free migration, prosperity will be transferred from, if I may use these terms, from north to south, and back again as well. And I think that is exactly the approach that you are giving an example of, is that it's through the, because there have not been this division, traditionally this division between north and south in this country, you've had more free trade, more capital migration, and more labor migration than perhaps that you see in the global economy, dividing the global economy into north and south. So that's the alternative to the international income redistribution crowd, the Brandt Report, and so on and so forth. It's the international transfer of prosperity. It's the free market approach to economic development, which I had thought the Reagan administration was committed to. But in fact, that commitment was really, it wasn't there.
Mr. Barron?
And two points.
square feet that they have to live by implication. The questions of governments in Cambodia and India and Ghana have been foolish. I don't think they've been foolish at all. They have been evil. It's not the same thing. You must not equate a gangster with idiots. the policies pursued by Tanzanian government are absolutely rational in terms of the objectives of the ruler. Who wants power? See, this is what I think one of the weaknesses of the traditional liberalism, using liberal in the traditional European sense of the term, has never come to terms with the phenomenon of power. I mean, I think the policies of the Indian government and the Tanzanian government alone have been perfectly rational in terms of their own objectives. So you are aggregating the government and the population. And I think there's very important disaggregation as well in that context also. And the second, I do not think we ought to claim more for the market than it can deliver. I'm a completely market-oriented economist, as market-oriented as they are. But there are a lot of people, everybody in the third world and elsewhere, prefer more to less. But the cost of material progress may be too great. And a lot of people, I think the great merit of the market system of order, they permit people to let their own thing, do their own thing. But there are a lot of people who have mores and institutions and culture which are not conducive to material progress. They're not necessarily incompatible, but they will slow it down. Now, I think the market system helps with a peaceful and unforced arose of the effort. But sometimes they are very tenacious. I mean, that we should not claim this blame and the power of order. Claim more for the market system than it can deliver. I mean, for example, the differential performance between India and Japan cannot be attributed solely to closer government involvement in the economy. I think a note that one Freeman, one of the others, said that that's the only explanation for the difference between India and Japan. This is not so. And I think, again, we must be careful not to oversell.
What do you also bring up,
for example, the reluctance of people to take sanction value on that.
Well, I'd like to answer that. Peter, could you just repeat the last point?
The reluctance of people to take animal life.
As far as claiming too much for the market and this question about somehow overselling the case, I think that I have one or two points to make about that. Number one is if you see the market vis-a-vis the government intervention, I think that the market wins hands down. We agree on that. There's nothing implied what I said, that I think that all countries are going to grow at extraordinarily high rates. That a country, if Jamaica, for example, adopts a Hong Kong-type policy, there's nothing in what I say that implies that the growth rate that will result, the GNP rate in Jamaica, will equal that of Hong Kong. But it will be much greater than it is now. And that's the claims that I make, and I think that that's the only sensible case to be made. The big advantage of the market, I think, is that it allows, one big advantage of the market, is it allows comparative advantage to take hold. This point has not been made enough. It's many people say, the free market is good because people will work hard and get the fruits of their labor and give people incentives to work harder, and I think that that's true. But it's also, incentive arguments have not been, in the general debate at least, fully developed. And the big argument, I feel, is the comparative advantage argument, which I make in my book, Development Without Aid.
I have two or three comments to make. Let me say that I have just introduced myself as a leader of the DPI. I'm an Indian who spent an hour with you arguing some of the things that Peter has been arguing. And I'm also a member of the so-called Indian intelligentsia.
I think they're, well, broadly agree with what you're saying. I think they're in some respect, in very major respect. The first, I think you might agree with this, the first is that I think you neglect the prejudice against foreign capital, which exists among the Indian middle class, if you like, for historical reasons, partly because it's associated with British times and so forth, which I suspect goes for other developing countries that have had in a period of the past. This is related to my second point. When you extol the argument about the value of funds, you neglect something which one learns from the Canon of and speakers also mentioning, which is why my question was, the question I asked myself is, how is it that in India we have not had private sector, private corporate sector, backing a party with any, for any sustained length of time, with any sustained strength, which would support the market? And I asked a very prominent Indian industrialist about a year ago, I said, imagine, will we have a free market at home? I said, it won't happen, but let's imagine. And after some difficulty, he imagined it. And he said, oh, that would be very nice indeed. And my next question immediately was, imagine now that we have free trade policy, that we allow imports. He said, oh, it looked very grave, and he said, that would wipe us out. Now, it seems to me that the reason we have not had endogenous reform within India, and the reason I can't see endogenous reform occurring in India, is because the private corporate sector has in a sense sold itself out. And we've got mercantilist controls, private sector like mercantilism. And it's exchanged in exchange for the freedom of enterprise in exchange for monopoly in the whole market. So, I mean, you may well install raw comparative advantage, so may I, so may Peter. But it's not going to happen unless there are endogenous political forces within the country which are going to back it, in a sense. So it seems to me that it's an argument about power. You've left out, all the academics may, you may wax and wane until the cows come home about what good things about advantage is, but until one sees an endogeneity, an endogenous political reform, you're not going to find it happening. So it seems to me that your argument, while I broadly agree with it, is incomplete. And it also does not account for the prejudice against foreign capital just as there is against foreign labor.
Well, there's prejudices against foreign capital, and perhaps the function of an economist is to point out the costs of such prejudices. There's prejudices against, and there's political pressures that will work against the comparative advantage, prevent comparative advantage from being introduced. And one function of the economist is to point out the cost of such a thing. I'd like to talk, though, elaborate a little bit on this idea of prejudice against foreign capital that exists in many less developed countries, particularly with respect to their colonial background. And in my book, but in more elaborate form, in an article I wrote for the Wall Street Journal, which is entitled Foreign Aid and the Gang of Four, which appeared in December, I argued the following case with respect to Taiwan. I think that there's a great message to be learned. Sun Yat-sen and after him, Chang, had a policy which was against the importation of free importation of foreign capital. They had, the nationalist Chinese, had a bias against, or prejudice as you put it, against the importation of foreign capital. And they developed economic policies which would fit into that bias. In fact, what you had in the early post-World War II period, in the 40s and the 50s, late 40s and 50s, in Taiwan, but basically protectionist policies, import substitution, restrictions on the imports of foreign capital. One of the results of following big government protectionist restrictive policies was the stagnation of the Taiwanese economy, as most economists, or many economists at least, would predict. The result was that they had continual balance of payments deficits, the Taiwanese currency was weak, and so on and so forth, and the United States came in with foreign aid to help the Taiwanese economy. And in fact, what happened was that foreign aid facilitated, encouraged and facilitated the protectionist policies, the restrictions on foreign private capital import. It was eventually realized in the United States that what we thought we were promoting in Taiwan was a model of capitalistic development, what we were in effect promoting was socialism in Taiwan. And at the same time in Taiwan, it was realized that the fear of dependency on a foreign powers had in effect led to a real dependency, an aid dependency on the United States. What happened as a result, and this is the exception to the rule rather than the rule, was a sharp break in foreign aid to Taiwan from the United States. Is that the Congress was worried that the foreign aid was, so we were getting socialism there. This was met in Taiwan with a radical change in domestic economic policies. They switched from protectionism and restrictions on the importation of foreign capital to export promotion and the import of foreign capital. In other words, and a much more liberalized economy to boot. When economists like myself extol the Taiwanese experience, it is basically the post-1960 experience that I'm talking about. And the argument has not been made, until I think I made it, at least I've never seen it elsewhere, that foreign aid actually caused protectionist policies in Taiwan. When the foreign aid was discontinued, we had the free trade, free market policies that was responsible, in my view, for the prosperity that Taiwan has achieved. So if in India or other third world countries there's a prejudice against foreign capital, which there is, it is my duty to point out the costs of such prejudice. If people don't want to listen, I can't change the world, but I have my obligation to myself.
I just have one response to that. There is an equal number of prejudice against foreign labor as well.
I'd like to add a footnote to that. This I agree 100% with what you're saying about the economist's responsibility in this regard. But the West suffers not only from a prejudice against foreign labor, but we suffer from exactly the same prejudice against foreign capital. And we shouldn't be parochial in looking out at third world countries and thinking they're the only ones who have these narrow views. Just think of all the Arab money trying to find a home in the United States after the oil shock and the reaction of many people to that inflow of capital.
In fact, I'd like to even go one step further. When I argue the case for the Gang of Four, what I call the Gang of Four, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and Hong Kong, my opponents often point to the fact that they're small countries and that their experiences are irrelevant for the big countries. How could you compare Hong Kong with India, for example? And my answer to them is that, is there a big man's economics and a small man's economics? Does the law of supply and demand apply only to big countries and not to small ones, or vice versa? And you can make that case, extending that logic, to talk in terms of the North-South question. Is there a correct economic policy for the third world that's not correct for the industrialized world? The answer, in my view, is no. There's not poor country economics and rich country economics. In my view, the same policies that are intelligent and will succeed in the third world will succeed in the first world as well. There's no difference. In a sense, there is no development economics. It's a phony subject.
Because the issue that you link, the faith that you put in using the comparative advantage in the free market, it's very easy to talk about it at this time. The countries that have used it, yes, have progressed. What do you do when you get exceptions of free trade in the developed world? Textiles out, footwear out. What do we do with, I mean, coming from a third world country that is a free market oriented policy, we liberalize imports, as you suggested. Our textiles are getting in Sri Lanka. What is the solution? I think your faith in using comparative advantage is very valid, but in reality, I believe it's misplaced unless there's an equal commitment on the part of the developed countries to keep the markets open across the board. You can't have exceptions. And in the face of the fact that that is not the case,
what's the proper response by the third world countries to protectionism and
I'm not suggesting protectionism as a response, but what I'm saying is there's a
no, the question is, what is the proper response?
To protectionism
in the North, unless I'm being bold in anticipating your question.
Yeah.
But that seems to be logically flowing from what you're saying.
I'm not sure what the answer is. I'm asking you what the answer is.
Well, I'm bold enough to say I'm sure I do know what the answer is. First of all, let me say that I'm very sympathetic to third world countries whose goods are getting blocked out of industrialized markets by protectionism. I'm a lifelong foe of protectionism. I'm a free trader. I wrote a book in 1978 called The New Protectionism, which I may rewrite now. Many of the arguments in that book actually was also published by the Manhattan Institute, although in those days it was known as ICEPS. In fact, it was the first book in their series. I think it's wrong for industrialized countries to protect. I think it's wrong fundamentally for themselves, because as most economists know, that the argument against following free trade is in favor of following free trade and against protectionism is your own economic advantage. The error flows from not understanding that it's consumption standards that are the basis of the wealth of nations, as Adam Smith, we're all wearing his ties, except me today. But he taught us that it was the standard of living, the consumers that counted for the wealth of nations and not producers. That's number one. However, it is true, I feel, that we are hurting third world countries by blocking their exports to this country. And when we do it, and when the Europeans do it, the same thing. What should third world countries do in response? They should follow free trade, because free trade is the best policy for them to follow from the point of view of their own economic well-being. It's interesting to note that the countries that did the best during the 70s in terms of economic growth were countries that were heavily discriminated against in northern markets. In other words, it's this gang of four who have spectacular records of export growth and GNP growth during the 70s. Their goods were discriminated against in the United States and in Europe. They faced protectionist barriers. How did they respond? Did they respond to protectionism with protectionism? Did they bite off the nose despite their face? No. They continued the economic strategies that were working for them, which was basically a free market, free trade approach. And also, I must say, which I haven't mentioned to this point, low taxes, low tax rates.
Didn't answer my question. What do you do with the exports that are being produced in the private sector in these developing countries? I'm not suggesting going back to protectionism, but the real question is,
well, because
the if it's not going into markets, what do you do with it?
Well, it goes to markets. There'll always be markets. You can find markets in third world countries, other third world countries. United States market is not closed off entirely.
No,
in other words, what you do is it puts an extra burden on third world countries, but the implicit assumption that you're making is that somehow you produce these exports, you can't sell them anywhere. Well, if that's the case, maybe you can lower your price, and you'll sell them somewhere.
I think the easiest answer to power on this, which is you ask for a quid pro quo of your purchase, you're not just saying that no, you don't want to be foreign aid, you want to go to market.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's the two-way street.
You don't want foreign, could you please repeat that? You don't want foreign aid?
I mean, if I was Mr. Jai Watkin, I have to say,
right.
I don't want foreign aid, I also want guaranteed
market. Oh. Okay, that would be very effective. If he'd say it, and even if he said it, he probably wouldn't get it, because it's not the same people who are giving the foreign aid. I mean, who's responsible for the protectionism? And who's responsible for the foreign aid? It's different groups, yes?
Last question.
I wonder if we might deal for just a second with Professor Bauer's comment about the fact that we perfectly natural in Tanzania for them to behave as they're behaving, if they're in fact seeking power and that's their main goal, and they're willing to do whatever is necessary. Obviously, following a free market economy is not going to help them to do that. Can you make a case that if we could get coordination among all of the major donors, bilateral and multilateral, that you could effect perhaps some of the kinds of free market changes that you seek in some of these countries by working to improve them?
What I would do in the case of Tanzania is very simple. I would cut off all foreign aid to them. I would cut off all foreign aid to everybody, more or less, but certainly Tanzania.
Yeah,
And then you have an evil government, as Peter has said, and I think he's right. I accepted his criticism. I was being maybe a little bit too PR in the book. Didn't make the distinction between foolish governments and evil governments. But the best way to handle situations like that is to let the evil government wreak such havoc on the population that eventually there'll be a revolution and you'll have a change of government. I think that's the only solution.
That's
Lenin's. Is it? Well, he also had a beard and not much hair. But if it's a Leninist argument, so be it. The fact of the matter is that if we give foreign aid to countries like Tanzania, we're just, of course, even if it's coordinated, non-coordinated, we're just facilitating this barbaric government.
Thank you very much, Mel. I think Will Wilson Schmidt would have been pleased and honored by the papers presented in his memory, by the number of you who have come here to honor him and to hear those papers. I thank you all for coming and for sharing with us the opportunity to discuss these issues, which will eventually, we hope not too long, be collected in a volume in honor of Will, and we hope some influence in the current discussion of these issues, which Will will share. Let me close as I opened by thanking the people who made this possible and helped us to realize the program today. Ed Fulmer from the Heritage Foundation, Maureen Goldman from the Kirkley Society, and by no means least, in fact most important of all, Don Lipson, a man of whom it can truly be said he is fit to be tied. There is a reception. We'll start at 5 o'clock. Just a few minutes from now in the federal room just down the hall. There will be a cash bar at that reception. Don Lipson assures me that there will be a soft loan window open next to the bar for all those who have the proper collateral and the right moral intentions. Thank you very much.